I Wore the Wrong Shirt to Work Today is a series of short stories that have been recorded and produced in cooperation with CoastSiderRadio.com. They are intended for the express listening pleasure of the CoastSiderRadio.com community.
The Chess Game. I was 17 years old and I had just moved to London. I met some people and was hanging out at my new friend's house. His name is Steve, and his father worked for the CIA, which I found out later. We were all chilling on the third floor of their five-floor flat in the Belgrave area of the city. The father was playing classical music on the baby grand piano. The beautiful second wife was somewhere else, and the sister and her boyfriend were there, as was our other friend, Richard. There was a chess game going on, and soon I was engaged. The sister's boyfriend was my opponent, and he was thought of as very good. He even beat the studious father. In fact, no one had yet bested him. I was not thinking of anything other than playing my best game, and soon I had the guy in trouble. Everyone was now watching as the game was heating up, and I had him on the ropes. Hey, I never considered myself a good chess player, and I certainly had no thoughts of actually beating this guy, but I was in control. And once a chess game goes bad, it is hard to turn around, and he was struggling. The longer the game lasted, the slower the moves came. I only remember beginning to see the shift, and soon I was swinging for the head, as you might say. The harder I pushed, the further from the win I moved. Maybe that was what made him so good. Psychologically, he was draining my energy. I am not sure how the game started. I had no strategy. I was not then, and am not now, a skilled chess player. I was just a risk-taker that caught this guy off guard. He was probably reacting to what he might have thought was a skilled approach instead of what it was, a ball-busting bloodbath on the board. Somewhere along the line, he righted his thinking and did the only feasible thing. He worked me into a corner and settled for a stalemate instead of a loss. I was proud of my accomplishment that afternoon. I had played with the best, and even Stephen's father found interest in the game as it developed. I was momentarily famous. The flame of fortune was soon extinguished, as was my chess ego. Over the next several months, I probably lost 200 or 300 consecutive games to this guy. He was my age, a runaway songwriter, a Buddhist of sorts, mesmerizing and actually brilliant, with an emphasis on egocentrics. You'll read more about Sebe Cochisonadie in other entries coming up. Flying Upside Down. It was my night off. I usually poured the liquor, collected the tips, and spent them all on drinks. Sometimes, when I was really buzzed and didn't want to stop the party, I would shut the bar down and let the few chosen ones stay. I would secure them in the kitchen where there were no windows and light, tight doors. I would then lock the place up as if I was closing, and then I would darken the place and slip into the kitchen with the booze. We would drink until the sun came up and then quietly sneak out the back door. The drive home was deadly. Like I said, it was my night off, and I was rolling dice for drinks, and when you're hot, you're hot. I was drinking Irish coffees, and they were doing the trick. I won 14 drinks and drank half of them and placed a marker in the cash drawer for the other half. At some point, I had the great idea to go to this chick's house and see if she was interested in hanging out. I had just traded a little Fiat for a raised Baja bug, and I climbed in and somehow drove off. I knocked on her door, and I cannot remember her name, but she was very cute, had curly long blonde hair and a rough complexion, and she was sweet. She answered the door, took one look at me. "Not tonight, Tommy. You are hammered." Now I was hammered and pissed off. I jumped into the buggy and sped away in fury. I hit the main canyon road and punched it. I was moving through the gears and was screaming through a turn, one my Fiat would have sailed through, but not the buggy. I remember it like it just happened. It literally flew off the ground, rotated upside down, and slammed into the front end of a parked pickup truck. The sound was enormous, and all I could think of was the full tank of gas I had just bought. For a few seconds, with glass and stuff falling everywhere, I laid there and actually waited for the explosion. When it didn't come, I scrambled out the window. Yep, I was that skinny. I staggered to Kevin's door. Somehow I knew whose truck I had hit. It was a small community. I knocked, and to my surprise, he didn't answer. He actually slept through the accident. I was drunk, not stupid, though. I made a quick decision to split. I couldn't explain this to my mother, let alone the cops. I wandered up the road and remembered another girl who lived in the area that was friendly. I knocked on her door. When she asked what I wanted, I simply said, "Please open the door." I must have sounded needy because she opened the door. We laid in her round waterbed and listened to the sirens, and the searchers combed the area looking for some semblance of me. I refused to out myself, even though I recognized a few of the firemen looking for me, and they sounded worried. We had a pretty fun night, though, and somewhere I fell asleep. The morning light blinded me. I needed help getting out of bed and dressed. I was really hurt and could hardly walk. I was staggering home when one of the firemen stopped and said, "Are you all right?" I answered, "How's my car?" He answered, "Total, and so is Kevin's truck." Well, later that day, another friend took me to the hospital, where I was told I was lucky that nothing was broken. They also told me that I smelled like alcohol and not to ask for painkillers. Next, we went to the highway patrol station to get a release on my totaled vehicle. I was held for questioning by the top dog. He insisted on knowing where I went, and I told him, "Hey, I hit my head, I wanted my mom, and then I woke up in the bushes." He called me a liar, absolutely true, and he had me sign some papers, and off I went. I sold the wreck and came up with $600 for Kevin's truck so he wouldn't press hit-and-run charges. I went to work 2 days later as a walking contusion. Somehow I lived through the experience and spent the next few months walking and hitchhiking everywhere. That was a trip, and there are some stories about those times that I will get to sooner or later. BB guns, birds, dragonflies, and neighborhood girls. Juanita moved us abruptly from our home on Sunset Drive in Whittier, California. We took up residence in an apartment just off Whittier Boulevard. This was the second place I remember living. It was an okay time, actually. I was too young to figure out what was going on, and I was basically free to do what I wanted. The kids in the area had a fort of sorts, and we all hung around and did, well, I'm not sure what we did, actually. I'm guessing I was maybe 8 or 9 years old at the time. Shortly after getting settled, we moved again. This was the beginning of that repetition of moving. This was a large geographic leap to Pocatello, Idaho. Juanita married Larry, a Buick salesman who had two daughters, Mary Jane and Peggy. I was 9, Mary Jane was 9, my brother Dan was 11, and Peggy was 13. We were not the Brady Bunch. There was so much tension in that house that it was scary. The girl's mother had just died, and don't ask me, I don't know how or why. Juanita was the mean stepmother, and Danny and I were just part of the package. Now, my nephew, Jerry, had a BB gun, and his mother, my Aunt Mary, hated it so much that she gave it to me when we moved. I loved that gun. It became an extension of my arms. I quickly learned how to draw a bead and compensate for distance and wind. I was deadly at 9 years old. Dan and I went hunting in the snow, and I bagged my first bird. The problem was it didn't die. The distance was too far, and I only really stunned it. I was going to finish it off, but the soft-hearted Danny refused to allow it. So we carried it back to the house, and he made a warm home for it in a shoebox. And then Juanita refused to let him bring it inside, so he left it on the back porch. In the morning, the bird was gone, and the cat that took it left its tracks in the snow. Danny and I split on the gun subject, and I became a loner. Soon, I met another kid who had the same gun and the same key eye. We spent hours at the pond across the street that spring hunting dragonflies. We were both excellent shots. And then the dads in the neighborhood would take the willing boys on pheasant hunts. Our job was to walk out in front and scare the birds. When they flew, we dropped flat on the ground, and the shotguns rattled on behind us. I always had my BB gun on these hunt trips. And I swear that once I hit a low-flying bird, and I have no idea what kind of bird it was, but I heard the BB strike it in midair. Okay, the bird didn't stop or drop, but I know he remembered me that evening. So one dull afternoon after school, I was sitting behind the fence on our back porch with my gun, of course. A group of girls from the school were walking up the street next to the house, and I raised the gun and very carefully placed a few BBs across the backs of their winter coats. No harm, no foul, but I laughed and so did they. I have no idea what happened to that gun. It was a great cock-action rifle that held about 50 BBs at a time. It had a light-colored wooden stock, and the metal had the Daisy logo printed in gold on it. It is funny, but one afternoon, while we were on a fishing trip somewhere in Idaho, I shot a beautiful red-breasted robin. Shot it right off the limb, and it was not even a difficult shot. The bird just fell off the limb and was dead on impact. Something happened that moment, and I was remorseful. I was really sad and wishing I could undo that shot, but I couldn't. And I think, but I can't really remember, that this is where the gun and I began to distance ourselves. Although I was not done shooting things, I had turned a corner that would one day end my love of guns. Something I never understood. Okay, this is going to make you laugh and feel the same way I do, confused. It is not important to understand all the surrounding circumstances, so I will make this quick. We were living in Fresno, Juanita, Larry, Mary Jane, Peggy, Dan, and me. I am not sure what month it was, although I know I was only there for one school year, and that was the fifth grade. We were all going somewhere. I think it might have been on a vacation or something. I know we were all trying to get in the car and leave, and for some reason, Danny was nowhere to be found. We went looking for him, and we heard this bang coming from our bedroom. We all got there about the same time and found Danny standing next to the light switch with the plastic cover off and was holding it with a long screwdriver in his hand. He had this oops, I've been caught look about him, slightly tempered with fear. Okay, here's what happened. For some reason that I do not understand to this day, Dan took the plastic cover off the light switch and placed a .22 caliber bullet in the wall. Only it apparently touched the wires and discharged. And I swear this is what I heard Danny tell Juanita and Larry. I also heard them ask him, and with a flare of, "Are you fucking kidding me?" in their voices, "Why?" This is where I go to static swirling in my head. Whatever he told them really never connected with my mind. If I were to try and sort of remember, I think it was something like, I was trying to hide it. Really? Hide a bullet in the wall next to electricity? And what the fuck for? So you see, I really don't think I heard anything right that morning, because it still doesn't make sense to me today. Well, we never found the bullet. That doesn't make any sense either. And Danny put the plate back on the wall and just looked at us from behind his goofy glasses, revealing the Coke bottle accident chipped front tooth. I'm here tonight, so I know we must have left that morning, but I cannot remember anything else about that day. How to not quit. So I was hitchhiking to work on just another day without a car. At least I didn't start work until 2, but getting home at midnight was a trip and a half. It was a sunny day in Southern California, and I was standing there with my thumb out and my long hair too. A friendly police officer stopped to see why I wasn't in school. I was 21 at the time. He said he checked my record and for warrants, and then I could go. I asked if he could hurry up, and he said he could make it last all day if I'd like. No thanks. By the time I got to work, I was late again. My boss was a really good guy, but as a hothead, he started yelling at me again, so I quit. I was a folder operator in a print shop, so I looked around and found another job. It was actually a fairly good job, and I was pretty good. The drawback was everyone I worked with, and I mean everyone but a guy named Jesse, spoke only Spanish. I didn't care, but they did. And every morning when I arrived, they all started saying things I didn't understand. And when I asked Jesse what they said, he would smile and say, they said, "Good morning." Okay, I'm all good with that too. So I got involved with the owner's daughter. This was not a good idea, and she was whack for sure. In fact, she scared me. And this was way before the movie Fatal Attraction was made, and I was living it. I let her move in at my house because she needed a place to stay. There were some ground rules, mainly stay out of my room. So one night I come home and she was in my room with someone else. I was not jealous, just finished. I told her she needed to move, like immediately. She did, and I quit that job soon after. So I had a master plan. I was going to convert old telephone wire spools into very cool coffee tables and sell them at the swap meet. Perfect. I knew how to build them, and they looked like mushrooms. Here's the problem. I didn't have a vehicle, and hitchhiking with a spool table was tough. So I gave that career up after moving my inventory at liquidation prices, all two of them. I am not sure why I was standing on this particular corner again one day, hitchhiking, but there I was. And my old boss, my old hot-headed boss pulled up to the light and said, "What the fuck are you doing?" "Nothing," I said. He started on about all the work he had and being shorthanded and me doing nothing and insisted that I come back to work. We cut a deal. As long as I cut paper and folded it for at least 8 hours a shift, he would never comment on my arrival time. Done deal. I needed the rent money. I really wanted to quit what I was doing, so I schemed another scheme. I knew a bartender who was a captain of a purse seiner tuna boat that fished the Ivory Coast of Africa. He invited me to join the crew as a speedboat operator I would be herding fish. I was all over that. I would go fish, get some tattoos, get in some bar fights, make some money, and grow up. I was in. I sold everything I had. I gave my dog to my brother, cut my hair, updated my passport as instructed, and then hitchhiked to San Diego to meet that boat. Okay, that he was on the boat, but it was in Puerto Rico, where it always stayed while not out fishing, and he was the cook. Now, I am certain he told me he was the captain. The owner of the ship apologized, and that was that. I hitchhiked home and broke into Danny's apartment because he was zoned out and wouldn't answer the door. As I climbed through the window, I heard his M1 carbine rifle engage. Oops, vets are all alike, a little sketchy. I simply said, "It's me," and he walked back into his room. So there I was, nowhere to live, no car, no job, very little money, and wondering, what should I do? Well, you know I went back to the hothead boss, endured his joy as he said, "I told you so," and went back to work. Like I said, how not to quit endlessly. Oh, and it's still going on today, almost 40 years later.
Please stay tuned to CoastSiderRadio.com for future broadcasts from the series, "I Wore the Wrong Shirt to Work Today."